This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Today, for our This Day in History segment that's brought to us by Hillsdale College, we'll spend the whole hour celebrating this man's life on the day that he was born, March 4th, 1926. It's his 90th birthday, which is an accomplishment in and of itself. You may have heard of his products, like Nutrilite, or his direct sales company, a little company called Amway. Most of you have heard of his basketball team, the Orlando Magic. Some of you have heard of him, Rich DeVos. But after this hour, you will have felt like you've known one of the America's great treasures of your life, of our lives. That's how I felt after reading Pat Williams' book, How to Be Like Rich DeVos. And Pat Williams, our in-house leadership expert, the co-founder of the Orlando Magic, and the author of over 80 books on leadership, is here with us now. Pat, as usual, thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you very much, Lee. I look forward to our visit.
You bet. Let's talk about, well, I love to start stories where we should start them at the beginning. How did you come to meet and know Rich DeVos?
I met him first in August of 1990. We were pursuing a Major League Baseball franchise here, an expansion team here in Central Florida. And I was introduced to Rich through a mutual friend. I flew to Grand Rapids, Michigan for a few minutes with him. I presented our case, what it would take, $95 million was the expansion fee, and asked if he would be our principal owner. And he agreed. He said yes. When the first time I ever met him, he said, yeah, I'll tell the National League that I'll go forward with them. Well, as it turns out, we didn't get the franchise in baseball, but Rich was introduced to Orlando along with his family, and they felt very warm about it, liked how they were received. And when the Magic were put on the block, the original ownership group decided to sell. The DeVos family was first in line, and 25 years ago, they bought the Magic. And so Rich and his family have owned the club now for a quarter of a century, and obviously I've gotten to know the man quite well.
You know, if there was something that surprised you right out the gate, what might that have been, Pat? Something that you just went, wow, this isn't an ordinary guy. Tell me something. Share something.
Well, it would be a combination. You know, he's obviously a very astute businessman and passionate about his work, but he never neglects people. He's got a heart for people. He cares about the people that work for him. He cares about all people. And it's fascinating just to be in his presence and the ability he has to reach out to people of all walks of life, make them feel good about themselves. He will challenge you to live to your full potential, to take everything that God has given you and max it out. I've often asked him what his role has been with Amway over these many, many years, and he simply says, I'm the head cheerleader. And that's what he's been doing with people in his business and every other area of his life, leading cheers for them, encouraging them, uplifting them, empowering them. That's really who Rich DeVos is.
That's amazing. And you know, Pat, this is a recurrent theme we're learning, is that as you write about leadership, so much of it has to do with inspiring people to reach their God-given potential. And generally, the public culture, that's not the image of business leaders, is it, Pat?
Well, that's why I feel, as I wrote this book, How to Be Like Rich DeVos, when I finished it, I really felt as if Rich probably would be the, you could argue, the most unique businessman in the history of America. You know, he's had extraordinary success with his business. He's kept his family intact, never abandoned his faith, has been a extraordinarily generous contributor and giver, you know, to causes, schools and church work and hospitals, you know, around the world. And, you know, there are just so many facets of his life that he's been consistent with. I just think he may be one of the most unique businessmen in the history of America.
You know, Pat, you tell a powerful story in your book about your friendship with Rich It happened during what you called the worst year of your life. In a minute or so, share that story with us.
Well, that was the year that my wife left and decided she wanted to go independent, left me as the father of 18 children and a full-time parent. And so I remember going to Rich. I had this long, drawn-out explanation of what happened. Rich said, "Don't do that. Don't do that. Just say a brief statement, and then just close it by saying, and the children are all with me." He said, "That's all you have to say. The less said, the better." I mean, he was so helpful to me in that crisis moment. He's also been an extraordinary cheerleader and encourager for me through my cancer battle. I was diagnosed over 5 years ago now with multiple myeloma, and when I told Rich, and you know, was in tears as I told him, his reaction was, "Well, let's pray about this," and that's what he did. And every time I see him, he tells me, "We continue to pray for you, Pat." So to have one of America's wealthiest men and the owner of your team, you know, tell you that he continues to pray for you. Well, I can't tell you how important that is.
Very powerful, very powerful, Pat. To close this segment, we're going to hear from world-renowned artist and African-American Paul Collins on how he got working with Rich DeVos.
We went into Ada to have lunch, and I was told, "You're going to be working out there doing some stuff for Amway." I said, "Yeah, those are some weird guys, man. They may not ever pay you." And I didn't pay any attention to it. And I went out and I told Rich about it. And Rich told me, and let me tell you something funny. The same guys that told you that about us said, "You know, colored boys don't know how to do that kind of work." So we both proved them wrong. Rich was colorblind. He could care less about your color.
This is Lee Habib, the life of Rich DeVos, 90 years old on this day in history. This is Our American Stories. More with Pat Williams after this.
Went down to Florida and stayed with Rich and used his guest house. And it turns out that after that visit, we came back and found out that not too long after that, that we were expecting triplets. So Rich claims that that is the, you know, place where the triplets got their start in life.
That was former Michigan Governor John Engler telling his personal story about Rich DeVos. And you'll be hearing clips from all kinds of folks today. We're being joined by Pat Williams, who has a deep connection with Rich DeVos, co-founder of the Orlando Magic. And you can't know a person better, I guess, Pat, if you go into a major league sport and deal with folks day to day. Pat, we're going to separate this interview into three different segments for the rest of the hour. And the first is going to be Rich the Entrepreneur. We'll get to Rich the Believer and Rich the Salesman in the segments to come. Talk about Rich's father, Simon, his story, and how he shaped Rich DeVos the Entrepreneur.
Rich grew up in really not a wealthy family in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He had the blessing, however, of two very strong parents who were very interested in Rich and his siblings, and they raised their children well. Rich, from the very get-go, was fortunate to have a friendship with a fellow named Jay Van Andel, who was a little bit older than Rich, but they carpooled together going to high school and developed this friendship. And so when they finished high school, they did have, World War II was going on, and they did have a military obligation. But afterwards, they had an entrepreneurial spirit, and they got into all sorts of things. a flying school, a restaurant. Then they got into the boating business. I mean, they had all sorts of ideas, and none of them really worked. And then they learned about a food supplement, a vitamin, I guess you could call it, and they started selling that. And that really was the beginning of the Amway story. But I think the real story was this relationship that these two men had going all the way back to high school. And they maintained that brotherhood, that relationship, all the way through the start of Amway and up until Jay's death some years ago. And they never lost that connection. And fascinatingly enough, that has continued down to the next generation. You know, there's a DeVos and a Van Andel who run the company today. And that's been a beautiful story. So many companies fall apart when they move to that next generation. But the DeVos Van Andel story continues, and the company remains strong because of this wonderful team that has been going on now for many decades.
You know, and it's interesting, you know, they've been together decades and embraced all kinds of risk together, and I would only assume persevered through any number of crises. I mean, anyone knows, no matter what you're doing in life, from marriage to starting a business, the crises are coming at you. It's just a matter of when and whether you can get through them. Talk about the unique nature of the early days of Amway and some of the things they had to get over, and more important, Pat, get through together.
Well, Rich would tell you that the key was they never second-guessed each other. You know, if one was working on one aspect and one was working on the other, if it didn't work, you know, they were never finger-pointing or second-guessing each other. I think that was a huge part of it, that they had mutual respect for each other. They trusted each other's judgment and ability, and they never got, upset with each other because of something that might not have worked out. I once asked Rich if he was shocked by the growth of Amway, the worldwide impact of Amway. And he said a little bit. He said, but really, here's what happened. He said, Jay and I went to work every day, and we might add a new product one day. And he said, we might add a new country one day. And little by little, we kept adding, and over time, the company continued to grow. But he said, we never, at the beginning, looked at it and said, you know, this could be, you know, of this magnitude. We just went to work every day and kept adding something each day.
You know, there's a little quote in the book where when asked, you know, what was the answer, your quote from your book is, persistence, not the brilliant planning or blind luck or even clever planning, has been the key. Talk about that persistence, Pat. It's such a part of life that people don't talk enough about.
Well, Lee, I think that's the key to every aspect of life, isn't it? Just to hang in there, keep grinding, fight through discouragement, fight through difficult times, and just keep plugging away. Tenacity, maybe that's the word.
Yeah.
Or maybe a better word is the word Walt Disney used. He made up a word, and he called it stick-to-itivity, which is Disney-ese for hanging in there and not quitting, for persevering. That's a wonderful word and an important one.
You know, speaking...
And Rich and Jay certainly practiced it.
You bet. And speaking of Walt Disney, Pat, sorry to interrupt there, but Rich DeVos didn't much care for what Walt Disney called the naysayers. Talk about that.
Well, there are a lot of naysayers out there who see what you're working on, and they immediately poo-poo it, and they start downing it and start degrading it. And Rich really didn't have much use for that, but Rich did, and I've heard him speak. He, one of his talks is about something he learned from Walt Disney. When Walt Disney said there are three kinds of people in the world, he said well poisoners are one group who are constantly downing you and doubting you and pulling you down to their level. Everything with them is negative. And then the second group he called lawnmowers, well-meaning Americans. You know, we got a whole country of them waving that flag and going to the PTA meetings and keeping their grass cut, painting their fences. And then the third kind of people are life enhancers. These are people who have big goals, big dreams. They're going places, and they want you to go with them. They're building you up. They're cheerleaders. Right? And Walt said, and Rich does a wonderful speech on that. Rich says, that's who you want to hang with, those life enhancers. That's who you want to be marrying, and that's who you want in your company, and those are the kind of people you want around you. So Rich is always receptive to learning. He never went to college. He never was formally educated, but nevertheless, he is a lifelong learner.
And I wanted to read something on this as well, and from your book, Pat, about naysayers. He wrote, there is no shortage of people who stand on the sidelines and tell you it can't be done. There are plenty of people who think they are doing you a favor by telling you to give up and stop trying. Sometimes they don't have to tell you in words. The look in their eyes or the tone of their voice is enough to discourage you. Don't listen to those people. Don't be afraid of their criticism or rejection. Don't let them plant their fears in your mind. If you have a dream, dare to believe it, dare to do it, dare to make it come true. Pat, I wanted to play you a clip, get your response. This one is from Steve Highshutter, who worked for Amway for almost 30 years. Here's Steve telling the story of attending his very first speak-up session that Rich regularly hosted with employees, and what he saw and what he learned.
One person said there were no 7-Up in the pop machines. The other said the color of the uniforms clashed with the colors of the walls. I listened, but I couldn't believe the trivialness of all the suggestions or the complaints. At least in my opinion, they were minor. I made some snide comment, and Rich turned to me and said, you know, do you have a problem? I said, well, sir, to be honest with you, all these complaints seem to be so minor. I mean, here you're the president of the company, and someone's saying to you, they want 7-Up in the pop machine. I'm surprised at how minor these complaints really are. He said, well, do you understand the reason for this meeting? This is a speak-up meeting. Any problem, any concern, any suggestion that someone has, I want to hear about it. I said, okay. He said, do you understand that? And I said, yes. He said, then please keep your comments to yourself. After the meeting, a couple hours later, he gave me a call, and he said, I want you to know exactly what was going on in that meeting. He said, if I'm hearing that we need 7-Up in the pop machines, or there's uniform, you know, color issues, I'm not hearing anything about unions, poor wages, poor working conditions. He said, it's music to my ear. I enjoy that. As long as I'm hearing those kind of suggestions, I know we're on the right track and we're doing the right thing as a company by our employees. I never would have thought of that. It was so simple but pure genius. I never forgot that lesson. Be proactive. Go looking for problems before they get too big.
Pat, we're going to get to you right after the break. We're running up against a break. I want to hear from you. That's Pat Williams I'm talking to directly. You're hearing from a person who's worked for Amway for 30 years. We're talking about Rich DeVos, his life, his talent, his faith, all of it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is our This Day in History segment. And on This Day in History, Rich DeVos was born, the founder of Amway. And we're talking to Pat Williams, whose book, How to Be Like Rich DeVos, we're relying on for this interview. Pat's friendship with Rich, Pat's knowledge of so many of America's great leaders shared in his over 80 books. And before we dig into the faith side and the faith dimension of this man and how it related to his leadership skills, I wanted to first, Pat, get your comments on Steve Highshutter's, what he learned in that little speak-up session.
Well, Rich was a student of people. He was a student of life. And he had the ability to take those principles that he learned and then put shoe leather to them. I guess the word we were looking for here is wisdom, and Rich has had wisdom and a touch of genius, But it came from constantly listening and observing and talking to people and picking their brains. And, you know, that was, I think, really what makes him special. He didn't go to college. He was not formally educated. But he was educated by life, and he had this wonderful quality called wisdom, and he knew how to apply it.
Let's talk about his faith, and what I wanted to do first is let's hear from Rich DeVos himself on his faith.
I think the faith is the foundation of my success, because you work on a faith basis that you believe that God's got his hand on you, but as our business moved forward, you realize God has his hand on the whole business, and that he brought people to us who were like-minded people, or who became like-minded people. Because to do individual selling, you have to have faith in yourself. And that comes from where? That comes from God.
Talk about that, Pat.
Well, Rich is a man of simple, trusting faith, American values, love of country, love of family, and love of God. He grew up in a Christian home. His parents had a very definite impact on him. He was a church-going youngster from the very beginning, went to a Christian high school. And I don't think there's ever been a wavering period in his life when he doubted his faith or lost trust in God. But he's not ashamed of his faith. I love it when he's introduced, you know, to speaking of it or something. He'll get this flowery introduction, and then he'll stand up and say, "That was a nice introduction, but please keep in mind, I'm Rich DeVos, just a sinner saved by grace." I mean, I've heard him say that any number of times.
Yeah.
And so he's not ashamed of his faith, and he talks openly about it, and he loves the Lord and stays close to him. His children and grandchildren have been raised in that atmosphere. And, you know, that's Rich DeVos. What you see with him is what you get. And he's a strong, steady man, you know, and all the values, family, faith, love of country, you know, those values never waver.
And it's just funny. We did an hour on Johnny Cash. The day of his birth was last week. And that line, "I'm just a sinner saved by grace." My goodness, this is what drew so many people to Johnny in the end, the grace and the acknowledgement that he isn't that much different from the guys in Folsom Prison that he sang in front of. And that is that he too is a sinner. And so were they. And I think that's what so many people were drawn to in Cash's music. Pat, I wanted to play you a clip from Rich's friend, Don Main, the former president of Davenport University, who shared with us this story from your book.
He's a spellbinder of a speaker. And, he always talked openly about his faith, and I always thought, well, that's fine for him. If he wants to be religious, I'm getting along just fine without any religion. I was in my mid-50s, middle of a very successful career, and I just thought it was interesting. He always kept mentioning that, and I didn't understand that Rich wasn't talking religion, but he was talking about his relationship with God. One thing he said many times that stuck in my mind, he would always say, he would start his speeches off with the same sentence, "I am just a sinner saved by grace." And I thought, you know, if he's a sinner, what am I? As I was starting to get serious about my faith, and started to follow Jesus Christ, I started attending church and was doing the Bible school. And then at the same time that this was going on, I became sick. And I had a rare form of muscular dystrophy, which is similar to ALS. It's not ALS, but it's about the same end product of it. And then I underwent two bypass surgeries after I had, I think, 13 stents at that time because of restenosis in the right coronary artery. And every time that I went in for surgery or was in the heart hospital, Rich would call. and he would call and he would check on me and he'd say, how are you doing? And, you know, his health problems have been very significant, and he had a lot of empathy and compassion for somebody else who was traveling the same road that he was traveling at that time. And so he would call and we would talk, and then we would pray on the phone. He would pray for me on the phone. And it just gave me such courage, because the physicians, by and large, felt that probably my lifetime was a pretty short shelf life.
You can hear that. And remember, we were talking about that encouragement and that cheerleader. I mean, always cheerleading the people he knew and through his faith, Pat.
Lee, here's what I can tell you. Rich's faith is very natural, very comfortable. You don't feel uncomfortable in his presence when he starts talking about the Lord and what Christ means to him and his love of God. I mean, he handles it so beautifully in a very natural, comfortable way. Nobody feels uncomfortable or nervous when he's talks about his faith. It's a beautiful thing, and has been so valuable to me just to watch him and how he handles himself in those public situations, whether it's talking about his love of America or his love of God or his love of family. You know, it's just been very, very helpful to me. You could absolutely make a study of life just keeping a close watch on Rich DeVos and how he lives his life. I've certainly tried to do that over these last 25 years.
You know, I wanted to read another passage from your book. People have asked Rich if Amway was a Christian organization. Absolutely not, he replied. There are many wonderful Christian people in Amway, but there are also many fine people from other faiths involved in Amway. The fact is, an organization can't be Christian. Only people can be Christian, because Christianity is a personal relationship between Jesus Christ and an individual human being.
Lee, that's brilliantly stated, isn't it? That an organization can't be Christian, because being a Christian is a personal issue. And I love the way he said that. And I'll tell you something else. He's gone out of his way with his players that they can see Rich, who he is as a human being. And that's true. He's had them over to his house, and they, before the start of the season, they get to have dinner with him and his family. I think it's a beautiful thing. And to this day, after 25 years, these players, they've all scattered now. Most of them are retired from those early years, but they all remember him. You know, they've never forgotten Rich DeVos. He's been an owner the likes of which they've never had anywhere else in their careers.
Well, this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Today, for the hour, on our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College, the life of Rich DeVos. He's 90 today, the founder of Amway, and we're joined by Pat Williams and his great book, How to Be Like Rich DeVos. More after these messages.
He would always tell people, love you, thank you, I love you, or Helen and I love you. It was just normal for him to do that. And yes, I've heard it many, many times. And I enjoy it every time he says it to me. And we still give each other a hug. I'm sure that when we go to his birthday party, I'm in high cotton, because I know I'm going to be with a man who loves me.
And that's Pete Secchia, one of Rich's great friends, fellow Grand Rapids community leader, and a former ambassador to Italy. And how often do you hear men talk about men saying, I love you, to them? Men who become as prominent as Rich DeVos. He ended up owning a basketball team and owns one, the Orlando Magic, and is the founder of Amway. And yet, love, we hear about it over and over again, and that is animated, of course, by his faith. Rich, Rich was a believer, Pat, but as you said, it was a simple faith. That word love, it meant a lot to him, didn't it?
Well, and it still does. I've got a number of notes that he has sent me, and he signs them, "Love ya, Rich." I've got all those notes framed, by the way. I can imagine there are probably thousands of those notes framed around the world from people who got one from Rich with that sign-off. Or he'll sign it, "Proud of you, Rich." Well, that's a huge boost to people.
Oh, my goodness.
Boost to your soul.
Yep.
And it's not put on. That's just who Rich is and just the way he goes about life and how he feels about people. It's a wonderful story. Listen, you'll go a lifetime and never meet a man like Rich DeVos. And that's why it was so important to me some years back to do all the research and then put this book out, How to Be Like Rich DeVos. I remember vividly when we finished it, and Rich seemed pleased. You know, I got him copies, and he seemed pleased with the whole production. And it's still out there, Lee. It's still touching lives today.
Well, and hopefully we're doing that through this segment as well, Pat. I wanted to play a clip for this final segment in our celebration of Rich DeVos's life on his 90th birthday. And this is Rich the Salesman. And one of the most profound ways he's a salesman is on selling others on themselves. Here's longtime Amway pilot and head of aviation Rick Fidler with his personal story on a seemingly normal day flying four executives back to headquarters.
Shortly after takeoff, about 20 minutes later, we experienced a loss of tail rotor, which resulted in us doing an auto rotation and a crash landing in Lake Michigan. We exited the helicopter just before it sank in 320 feet of water. Then the Coast Guard eventually got to us about an hour 30 after we were in the water. And like I said, the water was 54 degrees, so hypothermia was probably getting very close to setting in. Once we were rescued and back to the Coast Guard station, when I arrived, the commander stopped me and advised that there had been a gentleman on the phone for over an hour waiting for our rescue and that he wanted to talk to us as soon as we got back to the station. He didn't tell him who he was. He just said he worked with us. So I went over and picked up the phone, and it was Rich. He wanted to make sure we were okay and that he wanted to let us know that he had been praying for us ever since he had heard about the aircraft going down. The next day, Rich DeVos had decided to fly back to Grand Rapids. He walked in the hangar and said he wanted to go for a helicopter ride. I said, "Well, where do you want to go?" And he said, "I don't care. I just want to go for a ride." So we pushed our other helicopter out. Back then, Amway had two. We took off, and he decided he wanted to go to Lake Michigan. So we flew out to the lake, flew along the shoreline, and then eventually headed back towards Ada. He asked us to land right in front of the plant, in front of all the windows where all the corporate executives sat. And he got out, had us shut the helicopter down, and we all stood out there in the front yard for a while and talked before we took off and flew back to the airport. It was very obvious that his goal was to come to Grand Rapids and show us that he had confidence in us, as well as show everybody in Ada that he had confidence in us by going for another helicopter ride and making us land right in front of the plant so everybody could see. When you talk about Rich DeVos as a man, I can't say enough about him. He has been a wonderful boss to work for, a wonderful friend, and when you talk about him being a cheerleader, yes, he is. He's the one that got us back in the aircraft again within 10 hours of the accident.
You know, Pat, you wrote one of the most profound ways he's a salesman is on selling others on themselves. Talk about that.
Well, that's a powerful story from that pilot. How many businessmen would have thought to do that? It comes down to the bottom line that Rich is always trying to build people up, make them feel confident in themselves, living to their full potential, you know, really achieving everything in this life that they're capable of achieving. I think that's Rich's real goal. Now, he's built this marvelous company, Amway, by inspiring people to really start their own business, become independent business people, and, you know, absolutely max out their business capabilities. But it goes far beyond that. Rich wants people to be strong spiritually, strong educationally, strong in their health, strong, proud Americans. Listen, Lee, he would have been a great president. of the United States. Can you imagine? You know, I've often thought of that, and I'm sure there were moments when Rich could have run and might have run, but he'd have been a Ronald Reagan type.
Oh, you bet.
If he had run, I often think what a great president he would have been.
I want to play another clip of Rich. This one from his famous Selling America speech, Pat, which delivered all across this nation. He loves this country. He's always loved this country. And in this portion of the speech, Rich powerfully contrasts the socialist and communist regimes on the rise at the time and compare it to the free enterprise system of America.
This is what you're going to hear, you know. Why, this is a rotten society today, folks. Did you know that? That dog-eat-dog free enterprise system, why, that's out of date. This is the age of socialism. This is a new age where we're concerned for our fellow man. This dog-eat-dog trying to outdo the other guy and make a better product and outsell him, that's not anymore. That's what millions are saying in this country, aren't they? But you see, what disproves all that is that despite this so-called selfish attitude we're supposed to have, last year the American people reached in their pockets and gave $10 billion away to help somebody else. No, you see, the average American that I know is concerned for the welfare of his fellow Americans. And he works towards that end and he gives to the causes that will help them. And so the next time somebody tells you our system is not conscious of the welfare of others, then you remind them that it's more conscious of it than any other group of people on earth. I don't find any Red Cross or United Community Fund campaigns going on behind the Iron Curtain these days. I don't see them enjoying the things we have, and neither do you.
Wow, you just mentioned, Pat, that this man could have run for office. My goodness, of course he could have. Listen to that, Pat. That's incredible.
Yeah, he was Ronald Reagan-ish. You know, he would have been a great president. You know, he had other interests, obviously, and that was not going to happen. But he always was a strong supporter of Republican candidates. And I once heard him say, he said, I understand pretty much everything in this world. He said, but there's one thing that I just can't understand. He said, a far left Democrat. He said, that's what I just can't understand, you know. So he was, very active in his political party. And in other words, if Rich feels strongly about something, the Orlando Magic or the Republican Party or his church or a hospital work, his family, his friends, oh boy, he is absolutely into it with undescribable interest and enthusiasm and passion. And that speech, now by the way, I've got here in my office, Lee, a old 78 recording of that, you know, Selling America. That was Rich's classic speech, and he gave it many times around the country. And boy, he could get a crowd really working. He could get them moving.
It's as relevant today as when he gave it. We've been having this same argument in this country from probably the 1930s on. And I wanted to end this where we had begun. Remember, we started, Pat, with the Grand Rapids artist Paul Collins. I want to play a clip from him. This is a final note of reflection from this man.
You know, one of the things that is incredible, and it's terrible stereotype, and Hermann Goering, Hitler's right-hand propaganda man, said, if you tell a lie enough times and nobody does anything about it, becomes truth. Now, this deal that they have that all millionaires bury their money in the Cayman Islands, that's really not true. And Rich is a great example of him burying his money in his community.
Pat, final minute. Talk about this man and what we just heard. And this is, he busts the caricature of the left about men of wealth.
I would encourage people to study Rich's life. Rich has written extensively. By the way, his most recent book is his autobiography. The book I did a few years ago would be very helpful as well, How to Be Like Rich DeVos. But I think the more we can learn from Rich's life, the more we can study him, the more we can practice those principles that set him apart, the better you're going to be, and the better your company's going to be, the better your family, and above all, the better your nation is going to be. Rich DeVos is a rare, rare breed. There are not many around, and never have been. But it's important to take all the lessons we can from this man and study them and learn them and then apply them.
Well,
your life will be much better as a result.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, our This Day in History, brought to you by Hillsdale College. And we were talking to Pat Williams about the life of Rich DeVos, the co-founder of the Orlando Magic, Pat Williams, and the author of How to Be Like Rich DeVos. Rich DeVos is 90 today, the founder of Amway.
Once upon a time there was an engineer.
Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear.
He had an engine and he sure had fun. He's good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says.
This is Lee Habib and this is Our American Stories. And it's time for our Wall Street Journal story of the day. And you were listening to the Good and Plenty theme song. That was my favorite snack. My parents would give it to me at the end of the week when I'd been a good boy. And I loved that song, and I loved the soft Good and Plenty. I hated the hard ones. I hated the old ones. I loved the fresh ones. And, well, today's piece is from Heidi Mitchell. And, by the way, we had a great segment with her on tickling last week. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and look up the tickling segment. It was fabulous. And, well, she had the burning question column, and last week she was on with us about that tickling. This week, her latest piece of art, which foods make the best bedtime snack? And for me, it was always Good and Plenty. That's what I love to eat right before I went to bed. It's what I love to eat any time of the day, frankly. Heidi, is this really a burning question? That's what we want to know.
Well, my burning question is licorice genetically loved or disloved? Because I can never eat those Good and Plenties. But yes, my late night snack is ice cream, as I'm sure many Americans are.
Oh,
you still doing
one.
Good and Plenties?
That's a good. Oh, I still. I yes, my wife. I have a stash all over the house. Anytime is good. Anytime is good. It's just my. You know, Ronald Reagan, as you know, it was jelly beans all the time. He had them everywhere near him. So that was his favorite
right.
snack, not just bedtime. Some people just have that one thing. What led you to this column, Heidi? What was on the mind when you wrote it?
Well, I'm a late night snacker. I'm really good at starving myself all day, and then just I can't take it anymore, and I just go for cheese and chips and ice cream. So I wanted to know what was driving that. So I spoke to Dr. David Ernest, and what was super interesting about him, he's at Texas A&M Health Science Center, and he studies body clocks. But he had this great thought, which I never really thought of, which is that, you know, we're working these ridiculous hours, right? All of us are on this 24-hour day work schedule. And so we skip meals. Now, someone like me, I'm just trying to keep my weight in check, so I'm skipping meals. But then, you know, come the end of the day, we need a little bit of energy. And so what that snacking, he says that late night snacking isn't even really snacking. It's meal replacement for so many people. So I was curious about that. I thought that was really interesting.
You know, in the piece you wrote, quote, but then after 11 p.m. or midnight, you're hungry, Dr. Ernest said. So what you're doing is not really snacking. You're replacing a normal meal with something quick and easy to consume. So this is the post-dinner dinner is basically what you're saying.
Right. Exactly. And especially if your day is stretching on past, you know, 17 hours or so, you know, you kind of need that fourth meal, or you've skipped a meal and so you're just super hungry. And so, you know, it is sort of, it's either an extra meal because you got to get more energy, or it's the meal you skipped because you were so busy during lunch that you didn't have it. You had, and you're not going to cook a healthful meal late at night, right? So you're going to eat whatever's readily available. And marketing companies are very good at enticing us with packaging and delicious Good and Plenties.
And then there's always, of course, that you're not hungry at all and it's 10:30 at night and you can't go to sleep and you want to catch up with your favorite AMC series. So you go downstairs and you open up the fridge and you get everything out of there and you just keep eating until you fall asleep, which is occasionally what I do. Isn't that the best?
I can eat a whole pound of cheese standing up at the counter at 11 o'clock.
We really cannot get together. I think it wouldn't end well. We'd both be in a sugar coma, and the cops would have to haul us off in body bags. Heidi, so it sounds to me like you were wondering whether other people had this weird habit that you had. That's what it sounds like it was going on there.
Yes, I think that was the impetus for this week.
We'll see how
next week goes.
I think so too.
So what's interesting is that craving for, you know, high protein, high fat food late at night, it's fine to eat, you know, it's not great, but it's fine to eat that stuff during the day, but it's worse for you at night.
So let's get to that, though. What's the time? I mean, we're now turning this from a fun thing into a health thing, which we hope we're not scaring the listeners, okay? Because we don't want to talk about health too often, and this isn't a health segment. But why does eating certain foods at certain times of the day produce different results? In other words, why should we be eating some things earlier and some things later, and why maybe we shouldn't eat anything later?
Well, so if you're a night owl and you're trying to push through, you know, you want some high energy food, and your body will take it and it'll run with it. It really, your body, you know, it's on a clock, right? So it wants to wake up in the morning, be filled with like all kinds of yummy, heavy foods and push you through the day. But at night, it wants to start winding down, and we're wired that way for millennia, right? Or hundreds of thousands of years. So then if you eat that stuff late at night, well, then you're jolting your body back up to life, right? So you're supposed to be winding down, but instead you're like, no, I'm going to eat that bag of delicious salt and vinegar chips. And now your body's like, oh, right, it's time to wake up. So then you're alert, and your body, all the stuff goes into, your metabolism goes into action, all stuff happens internally, and it's just not good for your body clock. You're totally messing with yourself.
Yep. And by the way, it says here that maybe later at night you might want to think about eating things like cherries or bananas or a pineapple, and I can only tell you this doesn't work for me, because what I do is I get that 2-pound bag of Bing cherries and I wipe them out, and then I'm on a raging sugar high at like 2 a.m. But you know, I guess moderation is the key to everything, Heidi. What's your broad takeaway from researching bedtime snacking? What's the relationship between how we eat and how we sleep?
Well, you know, you should stop eating, you know, about 8 o'clock. But what I thought was super interesting was that what you eat like 12 hours before has an impact on what happens to you later on. So this doctor, I think this is pretty fun. He said, if you eat something high in omega-3s, like salmon, for example, at lunch, and then at night you go for your Mad Men binge fest / tub of Ben and Jerry's, you might be okay. You might be canceling out the bad fat protein stuff that's in all the ice cream.
Right.
And instead, it's all going to be okay because you eat that salmon at lunch. Only if you indulge occasionally. You can't live your life this way every day.
Yep. Well, Heidi, we always appreciate what you write at the Wall Street Journal. And which foods make the best bedtime snack? This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Go to our website. Better still, go to the Wall Street Journal and catch the article. Thanks so much for joining us, Heidi. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after this.
You find yourself in the kitchen. You see an eclair in the receptacle. And you think to yourself, what the hell, I'll just eat some trash.
No. It was not trash.
Was it in the trash?
Yes.
Then it was trash.
It wasn't down in, it was sort of on top.
But it was in the cylinder.
Above the rim.
Adjacent to refuse is refuse.
It was in a magazine and it still had the doily on.
Was it eaten?
One little bite.
Well, that's garbage.
But I know who took the bite. It was her aunt.
Well, you, my friend, have crossed the line that divides man and bum. You are now a bum.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And Well, we're still talking about food, because as you'll learn here, anytime we get a chance, we're going to talk about food. And my goodness, we love talking to Heidi. And she'll be coming on every week with her burning question of the week over at the Wall Street Journal. And my goodness, what are they doing over there? I love it. And we're going to hang out one day with Heidi. And I really am going to go out with her at 10 o'clock at night and just see how much we can eat late night. And in New York City, that is not hard. All you got to do is go to one of those great Jewish delis down on the Lower East Side and park it there for a few hours. And you'll get sick. It's a guarantee. Third piece of cheesecake. So, you know, when we're doing food stuff, you know, as we were talking and the Choo Choo Charlie came in and we were talking before the show, we all have our favorite snacks here. Right. But Hengler over here, a rant was building up in him. He's our health guy. He's the guy who's always trying to sort of teach us how to live better through nutrition.
I don't think he's had a carb in 9 years.
I think it's 9 years.
Wait, I thought you were going to start doing CrossFit with Greg at the beginning of the year, right?
But yeah, the beginning of the year. Yeah. But this is the Greek calendar. That's somewhere in May. Yeah. It's not the other. No, this is. Yeah, this is. So we've all got the guy at work who says, "No, you know that if you eat that, that does this and this, but better living through chemistry." And so, well, Hengler had. Well, I think he knows a lot about our lives, and we need to know a little more about his. And so it brings us to Hengler's rant of the day.
Yeah, I want to say in my defense that I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy that comes out and starts sharing dietary tips with my colleagues.
If you have to say I'm not that guy.
You are that guy.
No. That's not true, Greg. I was trying to work the other day, and you were talking about fluoride for 5 minutes. I was trying to work.
Okay.
No, in your defense, you don't actually say anything,
no.
But it's your body language. Like, you look at me when I'm picking up my favorite food, and you just shake your head.
It's all
like,
in your mind. It's all in your mind.
You judge me.
It's your guilty conscience. Yeah, I'm
judge me.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, this is just my take on the whole thing about, you know, when to eat, what to eat, blah, 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 blah. You know, the last thing, what you eat before we go to bed. It's just, it seems kind of ridiculous. I have people coming up to me all the time at my gym because people there work out really hard. And they ask me, like, what's your approach to your diet? And it's a question I always say, you know, we come to the gym and you work out for 1 hour, but what are you working in the other 23 hours? And a lot of these guys are working in garbage and they're blowing up. They think that 1 hour is going to somehow fix things.
It sounded like a self-help book. What are you doing the other 23 hours?
Well, I know, but they want to get ripped and they're kind of blowing it up when they go home and they eat garbage. So this is my proposal. I think that what we need to do as Americans is not, you know, what do we eat before bed, these kind of things. What we all need to do is not diet, but everybody needs to be hunger trained. Everyone needs to go through true hunger training. Now, you may think like this involves some kind of starvation or something like that. It is not that at all. Hunger training means being hungry for real food, like being hungry and say, I'm starving. Oh, I want a hamburger and fries. You're not that hungry. Real hunger is saying, I'm so hungry, I could eat a carrot. Then you're hungry. Because you cannot be hungry and go, I could easily pound a couple burgers right now. Because they taste so good. Anybody gets done eating a healthy meal, they can go off and pound, you know, a couple pieces of cheesecake. That's so loud! Turn it down! Anyway, so, okay. This is what I propose. You wake up in the morning, and first of all, so many people skip breakfast. The worst kind of breakfast is having no breakfast. You might as well have garbage instead of having nothing, because there is something worse than having a donut, and that is nothing. So have the donut instead of nothing. But don't eat until you are ready to eat something healthy. So if you wake up and, I could have some pancakes right now. Hold off. You're not that hungry. Wait an hour. An hour later, you may say, you know what? I could have pancakes without the syrup. You're still not that hungry. Hold off a little bit. Maybe by the time the second or third hour rolls around, then you're hungry enough to have something very healthy. And that's when you're truly hungry. You need to retrain your body and your mind to be hungry for things like vegetables and stuff. And maybe you don't want to eat plain vegetables, so you put a little hot sauce or spaghetti sauce. This is the one time where seasoned ketchup is actually valuable. You can put it on your vegetables and trick your brain into thinking you're having pasta, but really underneath that is broccolis and carrots. That's true hunger. That's my approach. Everybody needs to be hunger trained because everybody, oh, I'm hungry and they want garbage. No, you're not that hungry.
So a question. This is you said what you put in your body the other 23 hours.
Yeah.
So I did an hour and 10 minutes yesterday. I walked and I did some.
You walked?
Yeah, I walked. I walked for about 30 minutes because walking's good for you. Did you know that? And So I'm getting ready for the cross training. I got to start walking before I can run. And so here was my diet. Tell me what you think. This was my food yesterday. I had two big bowls of super sugar frosted cornflakes. Mm. That's how I started. But then in the middle of the morning, late morning, I got a little guilty and I had a couple of apples. Lunch, I had a cheesesteak with my wife over at Phillips Grocery. It was fabulous. And the hand-dipped fries. Very good. And then late afternoon, we were watching Judge Judy together, my wife and I, and we brought out a whole little thing of cheese and crackers. Terrific.
I don't even know what a hand-dipped fry is. What is that?
Well, it's a hand-cut fry. It's a hand-cut fry. Okay. Yeah, sorry, not a hand-dipped fry. Then there was a big plate of Hershey Kisses in front of me, so I had about 8 or 9 of those. And then, of course, we topped it all off with an early dinner, and it was Popeye's chicken. And so I had three pieces of fried chicken and a great mashed potatoes. Yeah. And of course, a couple of their biscuits because they're fabulous. And then, of course, late night after the show last night, I decided a couple of slices of square pizza sounded just perfect and a Coke. So this doesn't matter.
And a goat?
So this is no good?
I'm sure it tasted good.
Oh, it did taste good.
Judging.
All I said is I'm sure it tasted good and not getting blasted.
I'm Lewis, the lifeguard, and happy to say I rescued a drowning potato today. They drowned it in sour cream. Oh, what a shame. Because food's so much better. It's practically plain.
Help!
So don't drown your food.
Help!
In mayo, salt, ketchup, or goop. Yuck! It's no fun to eat, but you can't even sing. So don't drown your food.
So, in total fairness to Hengel now, I think we all admit, we love making fun of Greg, but yet we sort of long to be in shape like Greg is. He's in good shape.
That'd be nice, and
we're not. And he is. And he's got the clear whites in his eyes, and he looks awake all the time, and we're always dragging around.
I drink a lot of coffee.
You do. And we're always sort of, I think we're all dragging between the three of us an extra, what do you think, an extra maybe 100 pounds between the three of us?
I can lose 80 easily.
Probably. You can lose 80. So here's the deal. I think this team should go under Hengler's tutelage, and Hengler should be our food and exercise boss. For 3 months, we should lay down a challenge. We should put a weight challenge on the three of us. And whoever loses has to, wear a dress into the studio for at least a week. Who's game?
Who's going to supply the dress?
Oh, that's a Hengler. Hengler's he's in charge. Would you be willing to do that for us?
You know what? I would consider it, but like I said, my greatest pet peeve is people telling me that I'm judging them. And if you're going to sit there and tell me that I'm judging you and I'm doing you a favor, I can't do that favor.
Yeah, but we want your judgment. This is it. We want your judgment. We court your judgment. It's good judgment. Look at my day of diet. This is not a healthy thing. This is not a good way to live.
No, but if... I mean, okay.
And my body's hard. Or, by the way, my best friend who does what you do, you know what he told me I had to do?
What?
He said, here's what you got to do. You got to not eat for 3 days. Just get hungry. Just fast.
Yeah.
And then start eating just the simplest things, like anything that grows. Stay on the outside aisles. It's carrots. Mm-hmm. It's broccoli. It's fish. It's chicken grilled, and that's it. And don't eat anything else. Water, and then lots of water. Get the soda out of your life. Beer is... Beer's got
to
go.
Is it true? I hear that one craft IPA is equivalent to 7 slices of bread. Can that be possible?
All I know is... what's the guy who did the movie Trainspotting? He needed to lose weight to get down to look like a heroin addict, and he said... All I did was stop drinking beer.
Yeah. Well, that's not fair. Then he has to lose more weight.
Well, I don't want to quit drinking beer. I love beer.
That's true. That's going to be really hard for you then. Well, this is what we do here in Our American Stories every once in a while. Well, we just talk about nothing. And this was a whole lot of, actually not just nothing. It was really something. Because in the end, someone's got to lose some weight here in this studio. And I know I'm going to try. And Alex, someday. Jesse, you're in for it?
Someday.
Okay, let's look at May.
I'll check my calendar.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after this. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this is the story of a son's tribute to his father. And we love father-son stories here, and mother-daughter and father-daughter. Just we love family stories. The son and voice behind this piece, titled Me, My Dad, and American Pharoah, is Gary Ginsberg. He's the communications chief over at Time Warner. And if you are unfamiliar with the name American Pharoah, he is an American thoroughbred racehorse who won the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup in 2015. In winning all four races, he became the first horse to win the, quote, Grand Slam of American horse racing. I'm a huge horse racing fan. Took my little girl to the opening meet at Santa Anita late past this December. Here's the story Gary wrote of his father, Irwin, in the New York Times.
And they're into the stretch, and American Pharoah makes his run for glory as they come into the final furlong. Frosted is second with 1/8 of a mile to go. American Pharoah's got a two-length lead. Frosted is all out at the 16th pole. And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
He did it. American Pharoah has ended the 37-year drought.
When American Pharoah crossed the finish line in Belmont Stakes on June 6, 2015, becoming the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years, I cried. After talking with friends who also watched the race, most of us men in our 50s and 60s, I discovered I was not alone. Many of us were overcome by emotion and, as it turns out, mostly for the same reason. We were thinking about our dads. For a generation of American men born during the Great Depression, racing was much more than a five-week diversion from the first Saturday in May to the first Saturday in June. It was an obsession. And the obsession was shared with us, their children, so that in many cases, horse racing came to define the relationship we had with our fathers and the little free time they had to share with us. For me and for so many of my friends Saturday, the one person with whom we all wanted to share this historic moment was no longer by our side. The joy and thrill of the race was tempered by a profound sadness. My dad, Irwin Ginsberg, has had four great passions in life: the law, tennis, his family, and thoroughbred racing, though not necessarily in that order. He developed his fascination with horses as a kid in Buffalo during what was arguably the sport's heyday. Following the exploits of horses like War Admiral and Citation, between the ages of 7 and 18, he had already witnessed an astonishing 5 Triple Crown winners, and he was hooked. He wanted to make sure I got hooked, too.
It's a beautiful morning.
Sunday, the one day of the week he didn't go into his law office, was race day. We'd pile into our Chrysler New Yorker and head from our home in Buffalo to the Fort Erie racetrack in Ontario. Once there, Dad would walk me through the intricacies of the racing form, speed ratings, past performances, class levels, before placing a series of exotic bets on the fillies and mares traveling the hard-bitten Southern Ontario race circuit. When he lost, which was more times than not, he'd angrily crumple the betting slips, ending up with a small mountain under his seat by the end of the day.
That horse, named Secretariat, is the reason why one of the greatest crowds in horse racing history has turned out here at Belmont Park in New York to see a...
But we were in front of our Zenith TV for the best race of all, the 1973 Belmont Stakes. Secretariat had already run the fastest Kentucky Derby and Preakness in history and came to the Race of Champions as the prohibitive favorite. For my dad, it represented the best chance to end a 25-year Triple Crown drought. My 11-year-old self sensed the moment's historic significance, so I brought my tape recorder.
And you will see, and Secretariat being led, he is
number is two, but he goes into the number one post.
Listening to that cassette today, I can hear the tension in my father's voice as the horses make their way to the starting gate.
Move, move!
He yells at me to move away from the screen, though the race is still a minute from post.
We're ready to go for this tremendous Belmont Stakes.
Then the race starts.
In line, and they're on.
And it quickly becomes a two-horse contest, with Secretariat pulling away after the half-mile pole. We're quiet at first, but the silence breaks when I shout, "He's going to win!"
Shh.
My father shushes me, and we both go quiet again until Secretariat rounds the final turn.
Secretariat is widening now. He is moving like a tremendous machine. Secretariat by 12. Secretariat by 14 lengths on the turn. Sam is dropping back.
My father starts repeating, "Oh my God, oh my God."
The Secretariat is all alone. He's out there almost a 16th of a mile away from the rest of the horses.
While I'm unable to control my prepubescent excitement, I begin screaming again at the screen.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front.
In the years that followed, we watched Seattle Slough and Affirmed win their Triple Crowns and continued our Sunday traditions at the track. Eventually, with me adding to the mountain under our seats, thanks to my paper route earnings. Then I left Buffalo for college, law school, and life in New York, and another Triple Crown drought set in. A decade ago, my father found out he had Alzheimer's. His mom, dad, and brother had all had the disease. He had feared it his entire adult life, and now he was to suffer the same fate. He was forced into a retirement he never wanted. But his love of horses endured. Three summers running, I took him to the Saratoga racecourse until the betting became too complicated for him. But the Belmont still held a special place. Even as his brilliant mind declined, twice he managed to travel by himself from Buffalo to New York with hopes of witnessing one more Triple Crown alongside his son. And twice we were denied. Standing side by side, watching first Smarty Jones and then Big Brown lose in heartbreaking fashion, were among the happiest moments of my dad's retirement and of my adult life.
Victor, you just won the Belmont Stakes, and with it ended the 37-year drought and got your first Triple Crown finally.
Just after the Belmont this year, my face still flushed from crying, I called my mom in Buffalo to see if Dad had watched.
It's just unbelievable.
No, they hadn't watched the race. He wouldn't know a horse from a rabbit, she said. Instead, they were sitting at the table, having dinner. My father oblivious that his 37-year wait for another Triple Crown winner was over.
Well, you might not be able to feel how fast he's going, but I can feel how happy you are. Let's go to Kenny Rice.
I started to cry all over again.
Great job on that, Greg, and what a story. I'm tearing up a little bit because, well, my dad took me to the track, and he took me to basketball games and took me to Atlantic City and had me play poker because he said a man who can't play a proper game of poker is not a man. I'm still working on that, Dad. And I'm taking my little girl on rituals. I mean, she's Santa Anita. I've taken her to the Far Turn, Belmont, you name it. She's going to go to every great track in this country, fishing, shooting, poker, whatever it is, do it with your kids. This is what they remember. You're hearing it in Gary's voice. Family here at Our American Stories. We care about it. We talk about it. It's all there is. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for news, well, you got the wrong station. And if you're looking for hot talk or some screaming and yelling, wrong again. We do stories and only stories here. Stuff you can use, stuff you care about, the arts, entertainment, health, the law, and housing. The stuff that affects your lives and organized in that way. And we love to highlight the topics that get left by the wayside when so much of our media treats politics as the first and only concern of most Americans. And again, one of the most important topics in our lives is housing. How accessible it is, how affordable it is, how stable it is. Today we're joined by Cassandra Bajak and Austin Berg to take a deeper and an all too personal look at how property taxes are pressuring Americans to leave their homes. I know this. I wrote a piece in the National Review about how my own dad, who had paid $32,000 for a home in 1961, could have never imagined that his property tax bill would be $15,000 for 1 year. And that was 40 years later. And Cassandra is a homeowner from a suburb of Chicago. Austin is from the Illinois Policy Institute, the state's premier think tank. Cassandra and Austin, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lee. Happy to.
You bet. Let's start with you, Cassandra. Let's start with just your story. And Austin, you'll come in on the policy level in a bit, if you don't mind. You and your family, Cassandra, live in Crystal Lake, Illinois, where the slogan is, a good place to live. Set the scene for us, if you could.
Well, it is a great place to live. And when my husband and I decided to move here from Elgin 13 years ago, we did look for a better community, better schools, good neighborhood and nice little downtown area, and we built our house 13 years ago. Unfortunately, we didn't expect our taxes to double. We knew there would be an increase because of the better amenities and, you know, local city and, you know, suburb schools and everything like that. We love that. But unfortunately, our taxes have doubled and are pretty prohibitive at this point.
And your husband was an Army vet. You have two kids. And you work in, of all things, the mortgage industry. But what you discovered is, well, at a certain point in time, from the day you became a homeowner to today, the property tax bill ultimately started to catch up with the mortgage bill. Talk about that.
Well, it not only caught up, it exceeded it. And we're seeing that happen all over Cook County, McHenry County, Lake County, everywhere in the suburbs of Chicago, including the city. But usually the tax base when we do new construction or, you know, evaluate taxes is about 2%. We're well above that, and Austin can give you the details on that, but we're at least double that factor since the values haven't really changed. The taxes have doubled, and we're trying to figure out what's increased, what's gotten better for us. And it's status quo, basically, but it just hasn't, we haven't seen a phenomenal improvement or anything from what we came here from 13 years ago.
You bet. And Austin, you know, just about my dad, he bought the house in 1961, and his personal property taxes at the time were a little over $200. And that skyrocketed to almost $15,000, and he had paid the house off decades before. And so here's a case where the property taxes were many, many times fold over his highest mortgage payment. Where does this money go, Austin? What's happening with property taxes? Give us a look from the top and the policy level in Illinois, but this is New Jersey. This is a lot of states, isn't it, Austin?
Yeah, that's the sad part about stories like Cassandra's, is that they're increasingly becoming the norm in Illinois. So Illinois is one of the highest property taxing states in the country, and we come in about number two or number three every year. And after Chicago phases in its record-setting property tax increase over the next couple of years, we're the odds-on favorite to take the top spot. So what does that mean in practice? Well, the average property tax bill, take McHenry County, where Cassandra lives, that comes out to $800 a month, average. So can you imagine just being, you know, a real estate agent in a middle-class area trying to sell that tax liability to new people coming into your neighborhood? I mean, these are good schools. They're pretty good schools. But you could pay for a top-tier private school pretty much anywhere else in the country with the type of money people are spending here on property taxes.
Yep.
So this is why you're seeing, you know, record-breaking out-migration from Illinois over the past few years, because who would want to stick around and pay that bill? It's just fundamentally unfair.
Yep. And Austin, do people ask the question now? I would think that they're getting increasingly wise. they must want to ask the question, where were taxes 4 years ago? Where are they now? Because then they can actually do a little graph. 800 today, maybe 1600 8 years from now. And by the way, when I retire and I've paid this thing off, wow, keep putting that line up, and maybe I've just paid off a home I can't afford anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically paying a mortgage you can never pay off, and you're renting your home from the government, and the government is not a very good landlord. So you see, since 1990, you see in Illinois, you see property tax revenues have gone up 3.5 times the median household income. So people are just getting squeezed left and right. 3.5 times the median household income. Incomes have been stagnant, housing values have been stagnant or declined, and property taxes get higher and higher and higher every year.
Amazing. Cassandra, now we've heard your dilemma. What are you doing? I mean, are you considering a move? What are you going to do?
Well, we really have to, unfortunately. Now, my children were born and raised in this house. We wanted to stay in Crystal Lake forever. You know, it's a good location for our jobs and everything like that. And we've appealed several times and to really no good result as far as that's concerned. They ended up changing the factors on us where our property value now seems accurate, but the factors have gone up. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So downsizing either here in Illinois to keep our children in school with their friends or moving out of state, which is a very possible option for us as well. We're really in a crunch right now where we're trying to decide that for our family.
Well, and it's interesting, and Austin, I'm wondering if you could weigh in here. One of the things we love to cover here on this show is where are people moving from and where are they moving to? And we just follow the annual Atlas Van Line Survey, which I think is the most fascinating policy look at this space than anything, almost any think tank could provide because, well, generally, many folks might not care about, you know, public policy the way we put it out at think tanks. But, man, Atlas Van Lines doesn't have a dog in the fight. They're just, well, it's just sort of an interesting tidbit. Talk about where people are moving from and to and why.
Sure. So you can look at moving company studies. You can look at IRS data. You can look at census data. All of those studies point to Illinois residents leaving for Texas, leaving for Florida, leaving for Arizona, leaving for Indiana, just lower tax states where you can get a lot more house for your money. And when you look at the survey data, the two number one reasons for moving, long distance moves, this is according to census data, is, I mean, this is common sense stuff, but it's economic reasons, so jobs, and number two is housing. So if you're in a state like Illinois where the jobs climate is among the worst in the nation. The taxes, the property taxes are among the highest in the nation. Wages are stagnant. Why wouldn't you move to a booming state where taxes are reasonable? You're not seeing out of control pension and health care costs for government workers. You're not seeing crazy workers' compensation costs that are hitting cash-strapped local governments.
Yep.
You're not seeing these crazy prevailing wage requirements you see in Illinois. It's a no-brainer for a lot of families.
You know, in Austin, what we're not considering, we did a segment on the Mercedes-Benz corporate offices in Montvale, New Jersey, moving to Sandy Springs, Georgia. And they said one of the big reasons was that the costs of housing were absorbed by them in payroll. So the businesses have to pay the cost if they want to keep their people put. And then they got to pass those costs along to somebody else. Talk about the impact of these higher taxes on businesses themselves, Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been doing a lot of work on manufacturing across the state. And when you talk to manufacturers, I just talked to one in South Cook County, and he's moving his 500 jobs. It's called Hoist Lift Truck. They make forklifts. They'll be moving their business, which gives about 500 jobs, great, I think, average salary in the $60,000, $70,000 range, moving them just a matter of miles to Indiana. And when I was talking to their CEO, Marty Flaska, he was saying, I thought this would be a tough sell to my employees, but when I tell them what they're going to pay for housing versus what they're paying in Cook County, when I tell them what they're going to pay in, say, sales tax just for stuff for diapers, for food, for anything, for any type of service or good, they're going to get it cheaper. Their quality of life is going to skyrocket. My bottom line will be benefited by getting out of this tax structure. It's a win-win for everybody.
Well, it is. And what I'd love to do is follow up with you, Cassandra. If you do move, I want to find out where you've moved to. I want to find out what your life's like. We want to do one of those WPA-like long-form stories where we follow people around from where they've moved from and to, and let the American public know this is going on not just in your life, because I know so many people are feeling this. It's happening in Cassandra's life, and guys like Austin Berg at the Illinois Policy Institute, well, they're keeping track of it all. Thanks so much for both of you joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and these are the kind of stories I know you care about. And by the way, folks, if your property taxes aren't out of control, get to those school board meetings. Petition your state legislature. When they say it's only a 1% or a 2% increase, say no. Say no, because 2% every year times 20 years, and the next thing you know, your state's Illinois, too. This is Lee Habib. Again, this is Our American Stories. You can catch all of our material at OurAmericanNetwork.org.